Hello and welcome to another edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hoag, your host. Glad to have you with us today. Today we're going to do some of our best of shows. That is, shows that have been most requested by the listeners, and I'm happy to bring them again along your way. One of the interviews, in fact, it's the most requested interview that I have. It's for my interview with Orson Scott Card. Apparently science fiction is very popular, still is. Mr. Card is the author of the Ender series. He's been involved in many screenplays along the way. And at the time we interviewed him, he was had a new book coming out and had just written a screenplay that was being tossed about in Hollywood and was just about firmed up to be turned into a movie. Fact, after that, it was turned into a movie, and many of the things that you'll hear him say during the course of the interview, his concerns about the way that Hollywood would produce the movie and things of that nature, really did turn out to be true. So let's journey back a few years and listen to my interview with Orson Scott Card. With us this morning is Orson Scott Card. Orson is the New York Times best-selling author and the author of the acclaimed Ender Cycle series, a series of books that has successfully crossed gender lines by creating a sense of wonder that pulls in readers of all ages and from all walks of life. Welcome to Kansas City, Orson, and welcome to KKFI. Tell me your feelings about the way you've been boxed in as a science fiction writer. Surely you think of yourself as more than that.
I've certainly written science fiction, and I'm proud of it and perfectly happy to have my science fiction novels labeled as science fiction. Fortunately, they don't label my non-science fiction novels as science fiction, so I'm okay. I also have a couple of books in a series that I'm calling Women of Genesis, which are about, the first one is Sarah, the second one is Rebecca, about the wives of Abraham and Isaac, respectively. And another one will be coming soon in that series about Rachel and Leah. And so, you know, obviously those have nothing to do with science fiction, not a spaceship among them, no time travel. But I take the Book of Genesis quite seriously as a historical document and give it the full historical novel treatment for these really remarkable and interesting women. And I've written contemporary novels that have nothing to do with science fiction or the Bible. And so I'm perfectly content that each type of book finds its own readership. But the science fiction audience is one of the best groups of people you could ever write for. They're very accepting, very open. They're constantly looking for new things. That's the whole point of science fiction, is to not read the same thing you've read 1,000 times before. Now, of course, I have to exempt from that statement the readers of the Star Trek novels and the Star Wars novels, because they are, in fact, wanting to read the same thing over and over again, and they succeed in achieving that. But those of us who are writing science fiction, we try not to write the same book twice. They try not to read the same book twice. So I'm proud to be writing for that community, because they're good readers, and they're very accepting of all the weird things that I try in my fiction from time to time. At the same time, I'd like to think that I write science fiction for people who think they hate science fiction. I don't take for granted that you already know all the tropes of the field, and try to make it accessible to readers who have no idea how science fiction even works. Because science fiction does have its own way of being read. The reader not only has to follow the story and follow the characters the way that you normally would in a mainstream novel, but you also have to be developing your idea of how the world works, what the rules of science are, what the situation is, what the differences are between the reality of the novel and the reality in which the reader actually lives. And those things are brought in detail by detail, bit by bit, in the process of telling the story. And if you're not alert to them, you miss them. So you're really following two streams at once. One of them is the world creation stream, and the other one is the story stream. And it's very easy for a reader who's not used to that to lose track. Let's just say that I try to be as helpful as possible to readers who really aren't used to reading that way.
Well, you're the perfect person to ask to explain time travel to me. It seems that different authors create their own rules for what time travel is.
No, but that's the whole point, is there are no rules, because time travel is actually fantasy. It's not possible, and it is possible. We're all traveling into the future at the rate of one day per day. And so time travel one way along the track is at the same pace as everyone else is the norm, and that's what we all do. But you make up your own rules, and each subtle... When I teach writing classes, I point out that every single change changes every story that you could possibly tell within that world. So that if you decide that you can travel into the future but not into the past, that's one kind of time travel, or vice versa, that you can't go into the future, but you can go into the past, and you make up your own little scientific mishmash stuff to explain it all, or you make up the rule that you can't send your body into the past, but you can send your consciousness into somebody else who's living in the past, or that you can take pictures of the past, but you can't go, or that you can listen to the past, but you can't see, or, you know, whatever rules you want. Then you can tell a story that uses those rules as a framework. The funny thing is that even though we tell stories set in universes that are different from the present reality, we're still talking about the present reality. We just use those changes in order to focus more clearly the issues that we're dealing with. So that when Ursula Le Guin, for example, in Left Hand of Darkness, wanted to talk about what is actually real and what is not real about gender roles in society, she set it on a planet where the human race had evolved in a direction that made it so that we had a monthly cycle, like estrus in many animals, where you didn't know whether at the end of the cycle you would be male or female. Well, then it's not in anybody's interest to make it so that one sex predominates over the other, because you don't know which side of the fence you're going to be on at any given time of your life. And so everybody has the experience of being male. Everybody has the experience of being female from time to time. And yet when you are within that gender, you're definitely of that gender. And so, you know, very interesting idea that allowed her to speak clearly about issues in our society that were really important to her in the 70s when she wrote that. That's what we do in science fiction and fantasy. Even the writers who don't think they're doing that at all. Oh, I'm just writing for escape. That's nonsense. They're writing stories that they care about and believe in. And whether they mean to or not, those stories are going to deal with the issues that they care most about. So we who write science fiction and fantasy are still writing contemporary novels. We're just focusing them differently.
It is said that history repeats itself, and I guess
it absolutely does. And there's nothing so idiotic that happened in the past that is too dumb to happen again. You know, that people just don't learn from history, especially in America, where it's taught so badly that people have no idea what it even is. And so people are able to tell the most outrageous lies about what went on in the past, and no one catches them in it because nobody studies it. You know, there are a few historians who go, wait, that isn't what happened. Wait. And no one listens. No one cares because we make the past into whatever we need it to be in order to prove our point in the present.
Now, tell me a little bit about the beginnings, the genesis, as it were, of the Ender series. It started out as a short story that you then developed into a full novel?
Yeah, it was the first serious attempt I made to write science fiction, and it attracted quite a bit of attention. It worked better than I expected it to. You know, you always hope that you'll write a story that people will really care about, but when you're starting out, you feel like you'll be lucky if they'll print it your mother and five other people read it. But it came in second for the Hugo Award when it came out, and that was really very encouraging. But at the same time, you know, I'd already written it, and then I moved on. But then I was going to write another novel called Speaker for the Dead, and the novel really opened up for me when I realized, you know, Ender Wiggin, the character from that first story, should be the main character of this book. But I couldn't get from the end of Ender's Game to the beginning of Speaker for the Dead without going back to the short story and rewriting it as a novel. And that's the only reason it ever came into existence. I was kind of doing it just to set up the other book. Then it turned out to be my most popular book ever. So, you know, maybe it's because I had to relax before I could write it the way it needed to be written. But the truth is, I think that Ender's Game has a particular appeal because it's about human beings who are in isolation, being pressed by other people to do tasks that they really don't want to do. But they go ahead and do their duty and manage to find some nobility and even some freedom in the process of serving the needs of their community. That sounds very abstract, and you'll never hear it in those words in the book. The book is an adventure story, the way that it's presented. But I think that, especially with kids who are going to school, a place that most of them don't want to be, and under a lot of pressure to learn to behave in certain ways by society, and a set of pressures to behave in a different kind of way by their peers, that the story of Ender's Game becomes kind of a story about how to find your own way in the midst of unfreedom, to be able to make yourself free. Maybe, but I'm analyzing after the fact. I certainly had no such idea in my mind when I was writing it. When I'm writing a story, all I do is write down the story that I care about and believe in at the time. And if I start finding myself getting bored with my own story, then I realize I've stopped caring. Therefore, something's wrong with the story. Go back and revise it until I do care. And then when I'm all done, I put it out and see if somebody else cares too. And some of my books, the answer is not many people. And some of them, the answer is lots and lots of people. I'm just glad that I have some that, that people like, and even the ones that have a smaller audience. I think of my novel, Heart's Hope. It's a very dark and depressing book with a slow beginning, and it puts a lot of readers off. But you know what? I think it's some of my very best writing. And so I'm proud that it's out there, and for those who like it, they really like it, and they're glad that it exists too. That's really, you know, when we talk about writers who are successful or not successful, I mean, the word successful was used in your intro, and I kind of cringe when I hear that because, you know, I'm successful at some things, but I look back at my older fiction. There are flaws in these books, and you know, I've learned how to write better since I wrote them. Artistically, did I succeed perfectly? Never. I don't think I ever will. I don't know of a writer who ever did. But in terms of financial success, that has nothing to do with whether you're a good writer or not. That has to do with whether you coincidentally happen to have cared about and believed in the same stories that large numbers of people will really care about and believe in. John Grisham is successful not because he's the most brilliant writer who ever lived, but because he tells stories that resonate with a very large number of people. So he makes a lot of money. Same thing with Stephen King. King is a wonderful writer. He would be a wonderful writer even if only, you know, a few hundred people read his work. There'd be less of it because he'd have to have a day job. But it's wonderful when a writer can find a large audience. But it has nothing to do with whether his work is truthful or powerful or successful. That's I think there's a different standard of measurement.
Having said that, now it's moving into a whole new medium now. Motion pictures,
right,
being made from your work. You're working on your first screenplay.
Oh,
what
no,
are the adjustments?
I've written about a dozen screenplays. You know, you don't just start from scratch and think you can do it. I was a playwright before I wrote fiction too, so that I've written about 250 audio plays. So, you know, I've done a lot of different stuff and moved from medium to medium. But with screenplays, it's especially hard because you have to please two audiences. You have to write a screenplay that can be read by executives who will then realize that they need to put their money into it. And then the same screenplay is supposed to work as the blueprint for a movie that will be seen, a very different experience, by audiences, and that they'll love it and tell their friends, and they'll all come back and see it 15 times, and it'll make $1 billion. Always the goal of the studio, by the way, even when they pretend that it's just a little small picture and they don't expect it to make much. They really are hoping it'll be the big breakout that you know, earns worldwide millions and millions of dollars. But the two purposes of writing a script are absolutely contradictory, because it's very hard to read a script and know what you're reading. Very, very hard. And I don't know of many executives who can do it. So you have to write a selling script. And then when it's time to once you've sold it, then you have to go back and change it into a shooting script, which is a very different kind of thing. And a lot of the stuff that you have to include in the selling script, just so that it'll be clear to the readers, you have to remove from the shooting script. Well, so far I've been writing selling scripts for the obvious reason that they weren't yet sold. This is my first experience writing a script that is actually meant to be the script you shoot. We have executives at Warner who are sharp. They get the story. They understand what it needs to be. I don't have to write a selling script now. They understand how the story needs to go. See, I've had a lot of people whose first reaction to Ender's Game was, well, we can make it into a movie, but we have to change the hero from a 9-year-old into a 16-year-old because we've got to get that teen audience. And I just cringe, because the whole point of this is that these are innocent children, and there is no such thing as an innocent 16-year-old. He'd have to be really dim-witted to be non-skeptical of what adults tell him. But, you know, a 9-year-old who has lived in a completely sheltered environment where he hasn't had a chance to have experiences outside of what adults have shaped for him is going to be naive enough to believe things that an older kid never would believe. There's no story if Ender is 16 years old. But so many people have not seen it, and I've just, you know, come out of meetings just despairing that it would ever get made. But I think this time we might be able to do it. Wolfgang Peterson is a wonderful director. Working with him and his partner, Sam Dickerman, they are wonderful, sharp, storytellers. They understand how stories work. And so everything they say adds to my understanding of how the movie needs to go, and they understand everything I'm talking about. It's a great, great experience. There are a lot of good, smart people in Hollywood. You wouldn't know that from some of the films that come out, but there really are. And every now and then, that's why every now and then a really terrific film squeaks through.
Yeah, you talked about in the notes. It talks about the dehumanization of war and the way the children are conditioned through the use of playing a game.
Well, you talk about dehumanization. It's hard to think of an activity more human than war. You don't become dehumanized. You simply dehumanize your enemy so that you can do whatever you want to him. In your mind, you have to, and you have to. You can't go out and start killing somebody if you're sitting there thinking, you know, he has a wife, or I wonder how his sister will feel when he never comes home, or when I maim him. That's a terrible thing. You can't possibly conduct war if you're thinking that way about your enemy. You have to be thinking, that's a monster who's going to kill me. If I don't kill him, he's going to kill me, and if he gets past me, he's going to kill everything I love. Sometimes that's even true. You know, Adolf Hitler and what he planned to do, monstrous thing. But there were appeasers before World War II who honestly said, why do we need an army? If an enemy came to our shores, I would simply walk out, greet the enemy, and say, what is it that you want? Let's sit down together and let's see how we can get it for you. And I just think, well, that's swell, but what if the enemy says, well, I want to kill all of your Jews, and if you happen to have any gypsies, we'll kill them too, and then all of your children, we'll use them as slaves and take them off to Germany to work our factories. Hope you don't mind. At that point, you think, oh, maybe we do need to fight. But by then, you know, if you're an appeaser, you don't have an army. You have no way of stopping them. You've already lost. There are times when you have to fight. And so when I write a book like Ender's Game, which is about war, or Shadow Puppets, which has war as one of the central elements involved in it, I really don't write that much military fiction, but in this particular series, military themes are important because that's who the characters are, that's what they do. And it's not that I'm anti-war or pro-war. I regard war as something that humans are going to do because we always have, and I haven't yet seen a new species evolving that doesn't have those same needs, drives, and instincts. It's that you have to, you know, it matters a great deal in fighting a war whether your soldiers really believe they're in the right. And I think that one of the reasons that Hitler lost World War II was because most German soldiers knew that, in fact, it would be a disaster for the world if they won. They did their duty. They were loyal to the fatherland. But it was outrageous to them what was being done in their name. And you just can't fight as well when you don't believe in your own cause. Our trouble as a people is holding together a belief in our cause. You know, America is a great nation and stands for great things. We're a flawed nation. We've made plenty of mistakes. But I hear a lot of rhetoric today that would take our mistakes and act as if they trump what we do that's good. And the truth is, there's a reason why our democratic example has been followed by nation after nation. It's because the people who live in a fairly democratic society, one that still maintains good order but is otherwise democratic and reasonably fair, are happier than people who live in dictatorships or one religion states or one party states where there are no options, and if you offend people, offend the wrong people, you're dead, or you can't work again, whatever. It's better. And we're not imposing our will on other people when we go to war against somebody who would destroy what we stand for. We're instead genuinely bringing a benefit to other people. It's not that we should go out and conquer the world so they can be as wonderful and happy and free as we are, but we do have a responsibility to our own people to protect our people, and we do have a responsibility to help those who are trying to live in the way that we have already demonstrated is happier and better than some of the other ways that you can be governed. There, that's my sermon, you know. But
it was a good one.
I'm not pro-war. War's it's terrible.
Oh, it's terrible.
No one wants to go through it. But when it's forced upon you, you do want to make sure that you win.
In a work of fiction in general, not just science fiction, you can create your own reality.
Well, that's right. And I set up the rules so that I can decide who the good guys are.
And make it turn out the way you want it to.
That's right.
Do you have any plans beyond this cycle or series?
Oh, I'm writing many different things all along. I have dozens of standalone books that are not part of any series. I have four or five different series going at any given time. They are every kind of science fiction that there is, because believe me, there's more variety inside science fiction than there is outside it. And I have my poems, my plays, my screenplays. You know, I'm busy. The main thing is that it's all writing, because I haven't yet figured out anything else I can do that people will pay me for.
Well, that's interesting. Do you see yourself as a variety, really, more than anything else?
Yeah, you know what I enjoy best, though?
Teaching. What? teaching?
Yeah, but you just can't make any money at it. I have employees I'd have to fire if I ever quit and went into teaching full time.
Can you teach someone to write, or is that something that just has to be?
There are techniques in writing that you can absolutely teach. You can't give people the fire, and you can't give them the stories to tell and the passion to tell them. But you can give them the skills to be able to tell them more effectively, and that's what I do.
Yeah. Well, we've been speaking with Orson Scott Card, the author of the new book Shadow Puppets and the Ender series in general. Thanks so much for stopping by today.
It's my pleasure.
Orson Scott Card with a little Mation Williams thrown in there on the Arts Magazine program. Yes, that movie did get made. Some of the fears he had as to what they would do casting-wise, the age of the young man and all that, did come into play, unfortunately. So how anxious he is to go diving back into the movie scripts, I don't know. But I think it was a pretty decent movie all along. Thank you. I thank him for coming by. Orson Scott Card, a famous science fiction writer here on the Arts Magazine show. So we're going to take a break now. When we return, much more for you. We're going to talk about the Funk Brothers, the background musicians who did all those wonderful songs in the years of Motown. Welcome back to the Arts Magazine show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, the community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us. On the second part of the show today, we're going to talk about the fabulous Funk Brothers, the musicians that were the background sound of all the big hits in Motown, especially in the 60s and early 70s. You know, Motown was in a neighborhood. It was a series of houses in Detroit in a neighborhood. Some of the houses were offices. Some of them were rehearsal areas. Some were actual studios. But it was in a neighborhood in Detroit and had an actual Motown feel to everything, Motown being the nickname for the city of Detroit. So we're going to go back a few years when I had a chance to talk to some of these guys. Some of them have passed since then, but some of them are still around. And at this time, there was a movie, a documentary film being produced. It was called Standing in the Shadow of Motown, the story of some of these musicians and what happened to them and how this particular producer that we're going to hear me speaking with got them back together, as many of them as were still alive at the time, and how they played one more time for this documentary film. So let's go back a few years now. Standing in the Shadow of Motown, here's my interview with the Funk Brothers.
Well, I was really impressed with the camaraderie I noticed in the movie. There was one particular section where several of you were talking and there had been a riot had gone on. And one of you mentioned that you'd even be willing to take a bullet for your buddies.
And there he is. I don't think I would have.
Was that a frightening experience?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was frightening, yeah.
Bill said it wasn't a riot. Look, I saw white folks and black folks skilling together.
Yeah.
It was supposed to have been a riot where you're supposed to be hitting and fighting one another. They were skilling together. Breaking in stores. Skilling together. Right, Bob?
Yeah, he's right.
Yeah, he's telling you the truth.
Not only had they played together in decades, but some of them hadn't played their instrument in decades. Joe Messina, for instance, from Motown Movement 72, he stopped playing guitar and took up chromatic harmonica. So he, a month before the movie started, he picked up, pulled his guitar out from under his bed and started getting his chops together again. Eddie Willis hadn't played in 10 years, the other guitar player, because he was on the road for 20 years with the Four Tops after Motown left Detroit. And when he stopped touring with the Tops, he stopped playing for 10 years. So he had to relearn his instrument. Now, the other guys were all playing during that time. And one of the reasons why it was able to happen was that Motown was always very easy for these guys to play, for the simple reason that in most R&B house bands, the musicians, their background was R&B, maybe a little bit of rock and roll, blues. These guys had all that, but they also were extremely accomplished jazz musicians, which takes a much higher level of dexterity and harmonic knowledge. So when they came to play Motown, it's like a weightlifter who's can lift 500 pounds, but he's only called upon to lift 200 pounds. So it was easy, and the reason that Motown had the sound that it did was because it was so effortless and it swung so hard. Like Booker T and the MGs were one of the great house bands of the 60s, but they didn't have a jazz background. And their music is funk, it rocks, but it doesn't swing. And swing, you got to be a jazz musician. A lot of the Motown songs are these, kind of shuffled like a How Sweet It Is. We hear Jameson going doom, 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 doom. It's got a deep swing to it, and it's because they were jazz musicians. So when you have this long layoff, if they were called upon after a long layoff to play jazz, this wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. But they were called upon to play something that was extremely easy for them. So even with the long layoff, when they came back to it, it was tough this time around because they didn't have the chops. Yeah, they didn't have the chops that they did, and there were a lot of health issues. But that's the reason it was able to happen. You know, Ural, for instance, and the other drummer who unfortunately passed away, Pistol Allen, passed since the film. Neither of these guys had any business playing this movie. They didn't tell me how sick they were. Ural made a quintuple bypass, and he had it a few days after we wrapped the shooting, and Pistol was dying of lung cancer. They had no business. They were risking their lives doing it. And
you never know that, though.
And because it was so important, because they knew their whole life, this was their whole life right here. This was their chance to say to the world, this is what I did. And they'd never get that chance again, so they weren't going to miss it. So they risked their lives to do this movie. And, you know, thank God for one and unfortunate for the other, I guess, because Pistol's not here. But I think, you know, Pistol, if he had a choice, he would have rather had himself go out that way with his legacy preserved than to miss the opportunity.
But it wasn't so hard. But like you say, how it's supposed to be, the man to get us together. That was the easy part. His job was convincing us that we could do this, you know, because the first day I rehearsed him, you talking about some strange feelings. You know, I was scared to death. I said, shit, you know, I done told Slusky, you know, that I could do this stuff. And then I, when it comes to the point, I say, man, I can't imagine what we're going to sound like. It was scary, you know. And then all of us coming together at the same time, and I know he hadn't played in so many years, this guy hadn't played in so many years. I said, boy, we're going to sound a mess down here. You know, but after a few days, it just came in, and that's everything jelly came back to everybody.
Yeah, for me, it was a real relief because, you know, I went in there the first day not knowing if they could still play.
Yeah, so I know Slusky was scared.
I had 14 years in the project at that point, you know, because I had 3 years writing a book and 11 years searching for funding. So I was like, did I just throw out 14 years of my life? I didn't know. And then within 5 minutes, we were playing Heat Wave on the first song. And it was rocking. So I said, oh, thank God, you know. This whole thing has been a situation of being able to exhale because we lost two guys along the way. We lost Oliver Van Dyke and Robert White. Who died before I could get funded. And, you know, I was fighting a biological time clock because, you know, their age, and I didn't want to lose anymore. And, you know, when we finally wrapped it, I knew, you know, okay, the legacy's preserved now, you know. So I could let out a
not rap. Saying that we old.
You know what's funny? What did you tell me when Earl's wife said? You just said
about you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Earl's wife said, see, this guy Slusky, he putting all this money into me. He says one thing I can say, he got to be a crazy white man or a rich white man.
Yeah, I knew he wasn't crazy because
you knew he wasn't rich.
He called me. He said, I'm in Livonia, and I got a retainer for you. And it sort of shocked me, and I looked at it. I said, yeah, let me go out there and see him. Yeah. I knew he wasn't crazy. He had a retainer in
hand. Joe made a 30-minute trip in about 10 minutes.
How long did it take for me to make it?
10 or 15. You know, I don't think Muhammad Ali, he says, I could turn off the light and be in bed before it gets dark.
It was like
before your voice made it on the phone, you were next to the house, and it was 20 miles away.
And then I knew Heat Wave, because I played on Heat Wave, but I was steadily looking at that check, and I couldn't figure out that note part. Put the music up there, and I said,
Yes, it is. The main thing, though, is not so much being a headline, but just to put our faces on the records, the tunes that we did now.
Yeah.
And names and faces.
Names and faces.
To the tunes that we did.
And I moved out of Detroit and moved to the East Coast, and now I'm in Nashville, but I'm come in touch with a lot of musicians, and it's really hard when you're hearing stories about certain musicians that claim to have played on those records because of the, you know, there wasn't the credits on the records for a long time. That's the hardest part. And Joe Hunter's got the greatest story about Chicago. Go ahead, Joe. About meeting Joe Hunter.
When I knew the producer over at Chess's Records in Chicago, and he called me and said, come on, and do a few tunes. I got a few tunes and I want you to touch it. And when I got there, he came and got me and smiled and everything. He said, I want to introduce you to somebody. So I went to this guy, he introduced me to him. He said, this is Joe Hunter. And he said, I said, you're the Joe Hunter that worked at Motown? He says, yes. I said, you did Pride and Joy with Marvin? Yes. And I named a few other tunes. And he says, oh, you didn't give me your name. I said, well, I'm Joe Hunter, too. And he said, you the Joe Hunter more than Motown? He said, come here, let me talk with you. He said, I had to get this job, but I had to use a name. But he could play. He could actually play good. Anyway, he said he had to impress the people over there in order to get the job. So I said, I forgive you for the fraud or whatever, you know, for whatever you call it, using somebody else's name. I said, but don't do it no more. I said, you can go by your own name now. You got the job, and you're here, and they like you, you know. But he was another Joe Hunter. He was me. I met myself.
Tell me another joke. Huh? Told him about giving you half of the money for the session. The reason we did that, because the movie is about, you know, everybody you talk to, you say, what's the Motown sound? They say everything but the musicians, you know. Just like even in the movie, you know, there's a part in that way, you know, where I explain and say, even you hear some people may say it's the food or something. I say, I like to see somebody take some pork chops, a hamburger, and throw it down that studio, shut the door and count four and get a hit, you know. But everybody, so we said this way, whatever artist we want, we'll use no Motown artists. And we still got the Motown sound. See, so that, you know, because like one of the guys in the group said, you could say, we used to take a chicken out off the street or something, wring his neck in studio, and with the Funk Brothers, you got a hit.
So was it more like the artist had to adapt to you more than you to the artist?
No, it wasn't that. It's that we had the sound. That we think the basic Motown sound. We had the group had a lot to do with it, but the basic music Motown sound was the musicians. So in order to prove it, we used artists that wasn't associated with Motown, and they sung Motown songs.
And it still sounded like
Motown.
And it's
still the Motown sound. That's just a different word, but it's the Motown sound.
See, the whole thing is that when you think about it, like take the Supremes. The Supremes only sang on the Supremes. They didn't sing on the Four Tops. They didn't sing on the Vandellas. They didn't sing with Stevie. Stevie didn't sing with the Tops. Probably the busiest musician, the person at Motown was Smokey, because he was a producer, a songwriter, and an artist. So if you take all the tracks he was involved with, maybe it's 40% of the whole company, but he's still not on the other 60%. Well, these guys were on everything. So the only continuity that ran through the Motown sound was these guys. And, you know, most of the Motown acts, when you take the Motown acts out on the road, Barry, from the very beginning, had a different concept. He was looking for a Vegas. He was looking for this high energy. So, you know, you'll take a song that has, like, a great groove, like Get Ready, you know. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Well, when you see the Temptations play that live, you know, all these blaring horns, because he was looking for this big Vegas, you know, high energy. But the Motown sound wasn't about energy. It was about feel-good head-bobbing music. Mm-hmm. And that sound only came from these guys. And no other musicians could get it. And then the first thing that ever happened to me, I'll never forget, when I came out to Detroit one time, and I had never heard any of them play live. And I went to see Pistol. I went with Pistol to a club, and they called him up on stage. It was funny. It was at the Bomax's.
The Bomax, yeah.
And Pistol walked in. Pistol was very flamboyant. There was a guy, what was his name, Robert Thrasher?
Norman Thrasher
was singing. Yeah. And he walks into, you know, I mean, this guy's right in the middle of a sensitive bath, and Pistol walks into the place, goes, Norman Thrasher, the Pistol's in the house. Right? and Norman just stopped what he was singing, and he brought him off the stage immediately. He said, ladies and gentlemen, the great Motown, John Pistol Allen, right? And he started to play Heat Wave, which was his, one of his, because Pistol was the shuffle guy.
Yeah.
And my reaction was this, you know, because as a musician, I've played Motown songs for 35 years now. I can't tell you how many weddings and bar mitzvahs I played. The obligatory Motown medley of Get Ready, Dancing in the Streets, and My Girl, and Heat Wave. And they never sound like these guys, right? And the second I heard Pistol, this was the reaction. It was like, oh my God, that's it. You know, and I played these songs a million times with million musicians, and the first time, because it wasn't a sound, it was a sound that was the creation and the sole property of a very small group of gifted musicians. And it's proven by the fact that when they went out to L.A. and didn't use these musicians, they lost the sound.
Most of the artists is dubbed in. You make the band tracks a lot of times first and then dub them in.
Well, you never saw the artists.
Yeah, the artists had adapted them. It wasn't them adapting to the artists. In the early days, it was a give and take because they didn't have enough tracks. Everybody cut it live.
Yeah.
But, you know, once they got into, you know, eight tracks, the artists brought, you know, these guys cut first and then the artists came in. Sometimes they, you know, songwriters didn't even know what artist it was going to be for. They just made them cut. Then figured out, oh, maybe we'll plug this group in, maybe we'll try that group.
Well, that might be easier technically in editing, but I would think you'd lose the give and take between everyone doing it like that.
Okay, say like,
one process.
45 miles, everyone stop. Okay, when that drum solo in there, when we would cut that, when I did the drum solo, when Starr dubbed in, part of that record, he's singing my drum solo with me. Da 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 da. You know, he's singing it along with me. If I hadn't did that solo in there, he probably put something else in there. But he sung what I was playing.
But that was also the genius of some of the producers. If they cut something and they had the idea for the song, but the artist wasn't there, and then they'd hear something that happened in the song, they may, for example, on some of the Supremes tunes with James's bass line, they gave to the horns to play. Now, they would have never had that horn part
as part of the arrangement.
As part of the arrangement prior to cutting that track. But once the track was cut and they felt that groove, they said, oh, let's do this. We'll have the horns do exactly what he's doing. And also went like Euro said, to the vocals too, where the vocals certain things. And maybe if it wasn't the actual artist, the producer might have said, yeah, do it just like with the drums right there.
See, what was happening in Motown? See, a lot of other places, guys would just read charts and things like that. Motown, they would give these guys charts, but until the very later years, they were very minimal, just basic chord charts. And if you tried to write something for like a James Jamerson, you laugh at you, you take a look at the chart, hey, you want me to play this bull? And he'd say, no, I want you to do your thing. Just take, it was real, you know, it was a standard thing. He'd throw it there.
Yeah, he did that a lot of times in the studio. Took the music just off there and throw it on the floor.
And just one of whatever the hell he wanted.
Throw it on the floor and
step
on it.
Sure.
See, one of the things we're doing now is really, you know, the soundtrack is out in stores right now. And it's a 2-CD deal. The second CD will be out around January. And what we're doing is we went back into the vaults at Universal, where they have all the original multi-tracks.
That's it.
And there's two vault tracks in there. Keep Me Hanging On and Burn It Up. And we got 16 vault tracks that we pulled out, like the Diana Ross version of Inner Mountain, I Was Made to Love Her, My Guy, My Girl, a whole bunch of, and we're remixing them from the musician standpoint. So in other words, that means no vocals. And people, you know, said, who's going to do the melody? And my thing is to them is there's different melodies. Listen to the melody on a piano. Listen to the melody of that bass. And we're basically pushing faders and mute buttons all over the place, soloing instruments. So you can hear all these incredible parts that were buried for decades under the singers. So, you know, like some, we might have a thing where you got this full orchestration. All of a sudden we hit a bunch of mute buttons, and all of a sudden it's just Ural and Jamerson. And then we pull out Ural, and it's just Jamerson. And then we pull out Jamerson, and it's just Ural. And you get to hear all these incredible parts of it. And these are songs that we all know so well. And you go, oh, my God, I never heard that stuff. It's on.
When we would cut sometime in the day, right, go home, get dressed, go to night gig. And then after we get off our gig, maybe one of the artists or studio, somebody come in, arrange or writers will come in on our gig and tell us, can we come to the studio after we get through playing at our gig? Would that happen?
Well, they have the Motown Museum.
Yeah.
The studio where we cut. Have only you seen the film, or are you going to see it tonight?
I've seen it. I have.
Okay, well, you know where the song we did in the Snake Pit with Michelle? I think we're the first people to cut since they left there. It's been a museum for 30 years.
And, it's still workable?
No, well, we had to bring in a mobile recording truck.
We got a jazz museum there, too. Greystone Jazz Museum. Mm-hmm.
But the other half of the film that makes this so significant, you know, one half is the music, because when you have a monumental contribution of this size, it's very significant, you know, because these guys have had the impact of the Beatles, although they were faceless. But when you... this is also a story, you know, these are magnetic, riveting characters. And we were, you know, the movie also explores their life outside of just music, you know, the trials and tribulations that they had.
Right, it was hilarious.
Yeah, exactly. Dealing with each other. And it's a great story in just the story of these guys as a social unit, aside from the musical part. And the characters, like James Jamerson, was a tormented genius. So... he was very cinematic, you know. I mean, it was very easy to do these stories around Jamerson because it's the ultimate, like, sex, drugs, and rock and roll story. And there is a basic bad guy here, which is not Berry Gordy, it's obscurity itself. And the fact that these guys have had to endure this for 40 years and have come out of it with so much dignity and grace in accepting their position, and then at the end of their lives, which hopefully will be another 40 years, they get to go out like winners. And justice is done, and the fact that they were up, you know, I think it's much sweeter that they're getting their place in the sun now than if they had gotten it earlier.
Yes, those Funk Brothers were really something else. I had to edit some on the text of the interview, as you probably noticed, but nice, natural guys. Hearing their story and meeting them was really exciting. These were gentlemen that paved the way. Motown, no, they weren't the main singing artist. You know, they weren't Smokey Robinson. They weren't Aretha Franklin. They weren't any of the big names, but they were just as important. And Motown, of course, had a hometown feel to it in Detroit. And if you see the documentary, Standing in the Shadow of Motown, you get a nice feel of that and all that really goes into it as well. So we want to thank them. Hope you enjoyed my interview also earlier with Orson Scott Card. He has a current book coming out. It's at the bookstores right now. And thank you so much for him, for the Funk Brothers, for the producer of the documentary as well. Thank you all for being on this best of session of the Arts Magazine program. The Jazz Insider is next. He's got some great jazz planned for you. Jazz from 1 to 3, the blues from 3 to 6, right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hoge. We'll see you next time.